Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, When God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt. I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way. Your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
I want to tell you about the first time I was 21 years old and I saw $6 million of cash right in front of me. I couldn't believe it. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. That's what $6 million looks like. Insane. How the hell can I get this kind of money one day? And the guy who had the $6 million was a Jewish businessman who owned dealerships in San Fernando Valley area, and he gave me an advice at 21 that completely changed the way I do business till today. By the way, if you get value from today's message, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. Here's what this Jewish businessman told me. I said, how is it possible you got this much money and you're in your mid-30s, $6 million cash? He says, Patrick, there's one thing you need to know about Jews. I said, what's that? When one makes money, five make money. I said, what? He says, when one of us makes money in a business, five other Jews make money because we like to make money in groups. I said, so what's the benefit of that? He said, everybody keeps doing business together. He says, too many people, ethnicities, nationalities, cultures, backgrounds, they just want to be the one making money. They don't want anybody else around them making money. And then eventually they wonder, how come nobody wants to go into business with me? Because when you make money, nobody else makes money. So ask yourself the question. Number one, the person you're working for, does he make money and do you make money? And number two, the people that work with you, who report to you, if they give their best, do they also make good money the way you're making money? If the answer is yes, you're in a great place. Go do your part and eventually you'll make your money like that Jewish mentor shared with this 21-year-old 24 years ago, 23 years ago. If you got value from this video, give it a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. And if you've never watched the video, 20 Rules of Money, How Actually Money Works, click here to watch the video, 20 Rules of Money. Take care, everybody.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Okay, while I'm up here, as I'm usually doing multitasking. All right, anyway. Today, okay, I'm pressing the wrong buttons here. Okay, today's jump-off topic. It's open mic today, but here's what I'm starting off with. Energy independence, retail solar, and retail housing. Now, I guess part of the trending news this past week and even today will probably be trending for a good part of this week. You know, there are power outages due to inclement weather out west, where people haven't had basically the municipal services or even private services of, you know, for electric or water or even gas in some places. You know, natural gas where, you know, you can heat your home and cook your food, that stuff like that. So, Now, the people that are not worried about that, because despite this matter of fact, there are over 141 million households in the country, and 250,000 of those, that's less than 1%, are off the grid. 250,000 out of over 141 million. So there are people that, and see, this is what's not in the news. There are people, matter of fact, when Texas, anytime you see a house outage, there's always people in that neck of the woods that are off the grid that no matter how much snow falls, no matter how much ice, how much power has been cut off, bad water, because like down where, I mean, not far from me, you know, in Tampa, Florida, they, you know, they treated some untreated sewage out into one of the main rivers down this way in Florida, Tampa to be exact. And, you know, so the city is saying, well, you know what, and they're telling their customers who receive municipal water, which is most people that live in any metro area, you know, you need to boil your water and that type of stuff. So what I'm saying is, and you have people doing this already, become energy independent. Do not rely on municipal sources for your water or your electric or your heat. Become energy independent. Now, there's a never-ending slew of videos on YouTube. There are never-ending articles on Reddit. It's all over the internet that teaches people how you can become energy independent. In other words, like for instance, one simple way, if you're in an area where it shows you you need to boil your tap water, well, there are private companies like Culligan and other companies that they can deliver water to you. That's one way to do it. But, you know, you can go a step further. And now here's the thing. In some places, let's start with water. In some places, you cannot, and we're all walking on an ocean of water. There's groundwater all over the planet. Even in a desert, there's groundwater under that desert surface. So we have oceans of water that we walk upon all around the world. However, going to that terminal I brought up last week, Learn helplessness, that's the term I'm looking for. Learn helplessness, the typical westernized person in a developed country. In the United States is a developed country. Canada is a developed country. Great Britain, the UK, it's a developed country. Any others, you know there. The typical person on a critical mass basis in these westernized countries do not know how to tap an underground water source. We never learned that. So we're helpless to get our own water, groundwater. Now, you can harvest rainwater, too. That's easier. But a lot of us don't know how to do that, you know, and how to, you know, make it, you know, purified and all that other stuff. So essentially in 2023, even if you have a PhD in finance from the Wharton School of Business or Harvard School or Yale or whatever, when it comes to energy independence, household energy independence, that means the electric bill, the light bill, the gas bill if you're going to cook or heat or warm up your house, or the water bill, they're basically functionally illiterate. Because, and some people might say, well, I got enough money. Yeah. Most people use this money because once we begin, we're going to learn helplessness. The United States dollar or any government-issued legal tender is really nothing but a glorified food stamp. Can you live, and let me give an example. Let's go, and hopefully I can illustrate this properly. Let's go to DuSable, okay? Matter of fact, Chicago. DuSable, Jean, or Jean, as the French pronounce it, Jean-Baptiste Pont DuSable. Let me read about him. What's he got to do with energy, household energy? I'm going to tell you, I'm going to attempt to paint a picture here. All right, Jean-Baptiste Pont DuSable, born 1750, sunset August 1818, is regarded as the first permanent non-indigenous settler of what would later become known as Chicago, Illinois. And he is recognized as the founder of Chicago. Now, mind you, let me read this part again. This is very important. He is regarded as the first permanent non-indigenous settler. So Native Americans were in what we call modern-day Chicago before him. But for some reason, they're saying that Jean-Baptiste Ponte DuSable, they credit him, a black man, as the founder of Chicago. Sorry, let's go over there for this story. All right. A school, a museum, a harbor, a park, a bridge and road, and a snowplow have been named in his honor. The site was set where he settled near the mouth of the Chicago River around 1780s is identified as a National Historic Landmark, now located in Pioneer Court. Okay. Now, let's see. Prior to 1770. Let's see. All right, DuSable is first recorded as living at the mouth of the Chicago River in a trader's journal in the early 1790. Okay. By then, he had established an extensive and prosperous trading settlement in what would later become the city of Chicago. He sold his Chicago River property in 1800 and moved to Port St. Charles, where he was licensed to run a ferry across the Missouri River. DuSable's successful role in developing Chicago River settlement was little recognized until the mid-20th century. Okay, so let's go with 1790. Now, let's go with the oldest town in Illinois. Okay, and... okay, 1699, priest from Quebec Seminary of foreign missions found the Holy Family Mission in Cahokia, the first permanent settlement in Illinois country. All right. Then Deschutes priest Gabriel Morris moves the Immaculate Conception Mission from its present to St. Louis to Cahokia, I butchered that name, at 1703. And Illinois becomes part of the French colony of Louisiana. Okay, hold on, let me. All right, here are the three oldest towns in Chicago. I mean, Illinois. Kaukea, Illinois, was majorly important French. That's number one. 1714, Shawneetown, a village in Shawneetown, was established in 1748. And Edwardsville in Illinois is considered the third oldest town in Illinois. All right. So Baptiste DuSable, he wasn't the first one in the state of what we now call the state of Illinois. But let me paint a picture for you. Okay. Edwardsville, that's 1805. So, and that's the way they recognize it as who. Now, DuSable, a Haitian man, okay, dark skin. DuSable discovered a spot, a watering hole, whatever you want to call it, near the river, or what we now call the Chicago River, where it was a place where, and we got to think like a pioneer now, where you can trade. You know, I can build me a house. You know, there's plenty of food to eat, because you got to figure let's look at some of the skill sets DuSable had to have back then. He had to know how to hunt. You know, for meat if he wanted meat, and for fur, you know, clothing. And so he had to know how to hunt. He had to know how to homestead overall. Okay. So there was an abundance of everything there. And you know what? There was no such thing as the city of Chicago. There was no such thing as a municipal corporation. So basically, it was off the grid because there was no grid back then. No government regulations, no city ordinances, nothing like that. And that's why he was able to prosper. Now, he wasn't the first one there, because he had Native Americans there, too. He knew how to forage for food. He knew how to go out into the woods, because, like I say, a forest is essentially nature's grocery store. So he had all those skills. However, now that's before. Now, as more and more people discovered, and let's put it this way, because Native Americans were there first. DuSable came along after that, and then as other traders, okay, French traders, British traders, you know, European traders came in, and they said, wait a minute, man, this is a nice spot. As more and more people came, somebody said, you know what, we need to organize this into a government, and that's what happened. And year after year, maybe never, not at first, it's become a point where it's not like it was when DuSable came there. When DuSable came there, it was basically an unregulated, unincorporated area to live. Now, which means you can live at a maximum amount of freedom, a maximum amount of prosperity. Now, in 2023, you can't do that in Chicago. Too many people, they have a government set up, and a lot of the things that DuSable was able to do, you can't do in Chicago now. It's been outlawed. It's been banned. Now, however, in 2023, what you can do, you can look at, wait a minute, well, what did he do that we can do legally in 2023? There are unincorporated areas in the state of Illinois and most other states. Seek out those unincorporated areas of the United States, and there are plenty of, where you can go and virtually duplicate what he did. The Amish do it, the Mennonites do it, the Hutterites do it, and a lot of other people do it, and there's a lot of videos on YouTube. Just look up unincorporated areas or whatever state that you're interested in, punch into the search engine, unincorporated towns or communities or settlements. Now, on the Black Towns Movement, they did it too. You know, so now, what's that got to do with the topic we're talking about today? Okay. Which is, let me go, I got to find my studio again. Energy independence. DuSable was energy independent. He knew how to get his own water because there was no municipal water company at that time in Chicago, or what we now call Chicago. He knew how to heat his home with biofuels, which is abundant in nature. And there was nothing saying that he couldn't heat his home with wood or whatever that would burn biofuels. So you can't do that in Chicago now and other cities like it. But the other place that you can do it. All right. So he was, oh, and for, of course, electricity was not available back then, but so they used candles and, you know, stuff like that. And solar panels hadn't been invented by that point, but now they are. Now you do have solar panels. Now you do, they have windmills that you can install on your home or your place, and you can generate electricity that way. We have battery technology now. He didn't have that back then. So you can power your home independently of the municipal monopolized utility company. Energy independent. Also, now, in the title for today's podcast, let me read it, because I mentioned in the title, energy independence, retail solar, and what retail solar is about is in Africa, Asia, particularly rural Africa and rural Asia, you have people that are powering their homes, watching flat screen TVs, with solar energy, sun energy. But so how is a rural African who might be surviving on, I don't know, $1 or $2, how are they able to go solar, but somebody in the United States or some person in Western Europe can't afford solar? Is because in a lot of your, and I highly recommend the book, Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid by C.K. Perhollet, classic book, or watch his videos on YouTube, some classic stuff. In the westernized culture, we have not learned how to retail solar, and this is what I mean by retail solar. And a lot of out of the renewables that can make your electric bill go zero within about 30 days or so. If you go to Home Depot, Lowe's, or Menards, or any hardware store, they're retailers. Anybody of any socioeconomic background can go into those places and buy whatever hardware that they need or appliance that they need, as long as you have the money. The prices or somebody on Section 8, some type of government assistance to a billionaire, you can go into Home Depot, Ace Hardware, Menards, Lowe's, you can go to any of those places and buy something 7 days a week, 365 a year. If you go into McDonald's and you're hungry and you want a burger or some fries, everything is priced in there for anybody, for the poorest of people to afford it. Now, in this country, they have a lot of government programs. So you can, I mean, credits and this, that, or other, to help you afford solar. No. Why? Because solar installers do not know how to retail. They're selling systems that are too big for a house typically, that you necessarily don't need, and they don't know how to retail. In other words, price it where a person on Section 8 can afford it. In Africa, in Asia, in rural Africa, in rural Asia, they know how to retail. They know how to price stuff at a price point where a person in rural Africa can afford what they're selling. And there are plenty of people over there. Matter of fact, we got to bring some people on. We've had one guest call in from Uganda. Well, we had to do a different, tune into a different show way back. But we're going to, matter of fact, I'm going to see if I can get somebody on here soon. So they know how to retail. And retail housing. Retail housing. Retail housing is basically my idea of just like you go into Home Depot, Lowe's, and there's a house that anybody can afford, the same thing when it comes to retail housing. Now, the closest thing to retail housing so far is buying a tent, but we'll get into more detail on that at another time period. Okay, that's those are the basics I have for you for today. We'll go into more detail at a later date on this. But let me play this audio to give you the example of retail solar.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is, these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours.
and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Because it's cold, the beer tastes better, and so I get more customers.
Of course, the day you start something like this, is lights aren't going to come all the way on. Mood lighting.
Elliot Crump is the school superintendent in Shelby, Montana, one of the countless small rural towns that's run out of teachers.
Yeah, because at 20 minutes, the kids that come out of Bozeman and Missoula and our education schools here in Montana, they tend to focus on those larger cities. It's going to be nice to get them out here, see what it's like, and hopefully get them to join the rural teaching community.
250 miles away in Bozeman, 13 aspiring teachers from Montana State University headed out for Shelby.
What a good morning, gosh.
Shelby, Montana. I don't know too much about it. I looked it up on Google Maps. That's the only research I did. Zoomed in and it looked pretty brown, but it's okay. I'm excited anyway. I'm not there for the landscape, I'm there for the people.
I love small towns. I came from a small town, and I've always wanted to teach in a small school. So, yeah, I'm super stoked.
You are approaching your destination.
Ooh, we are approaching.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
So I'll go first. My name is Elliot Crump. I'm the superintendent here. I used to teach social studies. I'm originally from the Seattle area.
I'm Jake Lyle. I'm originally from Plains, Montana, graduated there in 2016. I'm studying English teaching, want to be an English teacher.
Good morning. My name is Ned Bardsley. When I grow up, I want to be an art teacher.
I would love the practicum students to go through this program, enjoy being here in Shelby, and when I have an opening next year, the year after that, the year after that, they're thinking, gosh, it would be really nice to be able to go back to Shelby and be a part of that community and that school. I don't know if it's going to work, but I hope it does.
Shelby, Montana spans 6 square miles and is home to about 700 families, one K-12 school, and one main street that runs only a few blocks. It's an hour and a half from the nearest Walmart, 3 hours from the nearest Costco, and 4 hours from the nearest major airport.
There are some districts in Montana that don't get an applicant for a job. You know, even 10 years ago, they were still pulling in people, getting applications, being more selective about who we can hire. Now it's just find someone.
Dr. Tina Versland researches rural education. For the last 3 years, she's helped run the program that sends future teachers on a week-long date with the towns that need them the most.
If you're a school and you can't fill teacher positions, what ends up happening to like your offerings? What ends up happening to your school, your students?
Can't find teachers. Young parents start to pull their kids out of school. They start sending them to neighboring schools. Maybe they leave that area. So schools can't find teachers. The, you know, schools die. Community dies.
Shelby isn't dead, but in small towns throughout Montana, this is already an emergency. Nearly half of all schools in the state now employ teachers who aren't certified. And almost all of those schools are in rural communities.
What was your temperature?
400. I think it's cooked.
That's good. So we met in New York, started dating in New York.
I was a city girl. I never thought I would be like in Montana. When I told my parents I was moving to Montana, they're like, where is that? You moving to the mountains?
The state. So you've been here for 5 years. You've seen people come and go.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. When we first got here, we hired 10 teachers, and I lost 8 of them within a year or two. I haven't heard of things that I haven't tried. If I heard about it, I would have tried it.
And that's 36. Yeah, 36.
One of the things Elliot has pioneered, looking for teachers outside of the country. In places where $35,000 a year is a small fortune. 4 years ago, he hired his first teacher from the Philippines. He's since hired 4 more.
Shelby is like, oh my God, this is really a small town? And I didn't even see people walking on the streets and said, oh my gosh, this is kind of, you know, it's like a ghost town or something.
I imagine you weren't like, I'm going to go teach in Shelby, Montana.
No, no. It's the Shelby he chose me. Even though we don't have that much of shopping malls and all the stuff, but we like the simplicity of Shelby. I could send money to my family back in the Philippines, and I could also save money. So it's really, really helpful.
So bringing the Filipino teachers here has worked. Right? They've come. They've wanted to stay. How it works in the long run, I'm not sure. Their end of their visa is going to be after 3 years. Then they can get a 2-year extension. After that, they'll be heading back to the Philippines.
It doesn't sound like a long-term solution to the problem.
It doesn't sound like a long-term solution.
Congratulations.
That's why Elliot and the whole town rolled out the red carpet for the MSU students. When they weren't in classrooms teaching, they were given the star treatment. They took Shelby's fire trucks out for a joyride. They shot guns. And they went bowling. But 20-somethings are 20-somethings. They want to know what happens after 8 p.m. on a school night.
See, it's the first one we get.
Oh, come on.
Casey, 22.
How do you up your age? I think I'm going to need to do that.
Oh, yeah, definitely do
how
that.
How do you do?
I got two.
You don't have a lot of options.
I don't have many options here. This is 76 miles. I moved it up to 50, and then
but you, I mean, you could be like a really big fish in a small pond.
It's true. Maybe.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Rochelle.
Josh,
nice to meet you.
So for someone in their 20s, like, what are the sort of things that you end up doing?
Well, other than going out on a county road and just shooting gophers or shooting basically anything, I mean, as far as the community goes, we have pool league, dart league, bowling league. When you're bored, you're bored.
Oh, bro.
Who here would move to this area if they were offered a job today?
I'd have to talk to my fiance. I'm like, I can't, like, totally put up my hand.
Jake, you're super down to move here. Like, you would move here now, but your immediate response was, if I can convince my fiance.
It'd be a hard sell, probably, for my fiance. She's an interior designer, and there's probably not many interior design jobs around Shelby.
I think the issue is a social life. So, like, the school's great, but what are you going to do outside of school?
Bowling league!
Small towns are probably not for everybody, but you owe it to yourself to give it a chance to do more than drive through it and experience it for yourself.
I don't know how long I can stay, and I think that's the problem we're facing. I don't know how I could help that.
Teacher shortage challenge and this education gap or challenge that Montana towns and small towns are facing in America.
I was calling teachers in Florida and California and all over the country to try and find teachers for these positions, just begging people to apply, not even to take the job, just to apply and take a look at us. And I just wasn't getting any applicants, or I get one applicant or two applicants, and they were people that I didn't feel had the skills to be successful teaching kids.
But what is a qualified teacher look like that the kids deserve in Shelby? What does that mean?
When that teacher goes into that class, the students are engaged in what is going on. They're interacting with the material, they're learning the material, and then they're able to apply it afterwards. That's what needs to happen. And I believe all of our Filipino teachers are doing that.
And so how did you even find a solution that, you know, that you can recruit from outside the country?
Just the idea that I want somebody that has a native English-speaking background. I want them to be able to come in and offer a high-quality education to my students, and I want them to be excited about coming to Montana and earning that salary, and hopefully I can get the town to grow on them in the long run, right? I think there are a lot of kids that are going off to college, and they're choosing to go into other professions. And when they choose to go off into those other professions, a lot of times that they pay more, and I think that's the initial reason. And so you have fewer people getting into the teaching market, and yet we still have the same number of these small schools.
Is it because teachers are not getting paid enough, that it's not a competitive salary that helps them live the life that they deserve?
I think that's part of it. You know, this conversation is happening in Montana. If you went down to Wyoming, the conversation would be very different. They are rural America, but they don't have the same problem. They forced consolidation in that state, and they got into a situation where they're able to pay teachers more, and so teachers will tend to go there and apply for those positions. I haven't heard of teacher shortages in Wyoming like I've heard of them in Montana.
How severe or how bad Or is it even bad, this teacher shortage that's happening here in Montana?
It certainly is. I don't feel it in Shelby because I think we've found candidates that are high quality that are willing to come here and work in Montana and in Shelby. For example, our Filipino teachers. They do a fantastic job. So to me, I don't feel like there is a teacher shortage because every time I turn around and I need to get a candidate for something, I can go to my contacts and ask, hey, I need a candidate for this particular position, and I'll have 20 candidates tomorrow.
Yeah. There's a conundrum here.
We have these candidates that are coming over. They've been teaching for 20 years. They've got a master's degree in their subject area, and I'm having difficulty getting them certified in the state of Montana.
Why is that?
It's beyond because they didn't get their degree from somewhere in the United States. So I see them in the classroom, and they're doing a fabulous job, and yet I need to send them back to school to get additional credit so that they can become certified in the state of Montana. And I can get away with it for 3 years. I can get them a provisional. But once they get that extension, those last 2 years, they've got to finish classes and they've got to do additional work to get that certification. So I understand it's been a headache over the past 3 years, but it's been worth it because it's benefiting my kids.
In this political climate that we have,
mm-hmm.
to say that a town like Shelby is recruiting teachers outside of the country
mm-hmm.
to teach the next generation of Americans. What are your thoughts about that?
I think the exposure that my students are getting based on bringing people from outside of the country is going to make them more valuable employees, make them more successful at college in the long run. So I think it's extremely valuable. So I understand this idea of I should be hiring an American, or I should be hiring whatever. I want to bring in the best person for my kids, and it doesn't matter where they're from.
Wow.
To me.
So actually, I came in with bias. I thought I would be here, like, facing racism. I was kind of gearing myself up and saying, like, I am the only brown person in this, and there's not going to be, you know, people that would welcome me. And I came in with a sense of fear.
Okay.
And I feel like a lot of people have that misconception of towns like Shelby, and they come in with that bias.
Yeah.
Like, what is your reflection on that? Because I am wrong.
My wife is Dominican. She came to Shelby with me. She was welcomed right away. We have a lot of Border Patrol agents that are of Hispanic descent, welcomed right away. We have a large Native American population, welcomed right away. We did not have a large Filipino population to start out with. We have fortunately had the opportunity to get some fabulous teachers from the Philippines over the past couple of years. I haven't heard anything but positive about what they've done with our kids, how they've interacted, how they've integrated into the community, and all of the things that they've done to be a part of Shelby. If there is racism going on in this community, then it's not something that I've been exposed to. I haven't had anybody come up to me and say, why are you bringing Filipino teachers to Shelby? There was a little bit of nervousness at first, even with the school board was saying, we're going to bring these people from the Philippine Islands. They're going to come to north central Montana, rural community, snow, cold winters. We're going to lose them. You're not going to be able to keep them. And I said, well, maybe we will. Let's give it a shot.
So now that you've seen that this model works,
mm-hmm.
there's a sustainability challenge. And that is the type of visa that these teachers are in. So
yes.
Can you speak a little bit to the sustainability challenge of this?
Yeah. Their current visa is a J-1 visa. It's to come to the United States and experience American culture and then take that culture back and share that in their home country, is my understanding. I support that goal. I love these teachers that I have right now, and I'm going to support them in any way that I can. When it's time for them to go back, they go back for a year and they work and they say, hey, I'd really love to be back in Montana and I'm going to work to get some other visa. I'm going to do everything in my power to try and get them here on whatever visa, whatever I need to do to try and get them back.
They are not here just to educate. They also invest themselves in the community.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. I do believe that the exposure that my students have received based on the cultural differences of the teachers from the Philippines that I've been able to hire, their quality as teachers, the ability to engage students and help them perform. I mean, there's absolutely no question in my mind that this is a good thing for my community.
But is there anything else that you wanted to share or something that you wanted to debunk that you didn't have an opportunity to kind of share with us today?
If you have skilled people coming in to the United States doing a fantastic job, why aren't they staying? Why isn't there some sort of a path to allow them to stay, continue to work with my kids, continue to have positive outcomes for the country as a whole, in my opinion? It's a really difficult thing for me to wrap my mind around, I suppose. And I know there's bigger issues. There's a bigger picture out there, and they're making huge policy decisions at the national level. But at my level, these people are making a huge difference by being here and working with my kids. Why can't I keep them, right?
Interesting. Now, what does Filipino teachers in Montana, Shelby, Montana, have to do with energy independence, retail solar, and retail housing? Well, in a place like Shelby, Montana has a little over 3,000 people. There's less than 3,200 people living in Shelby. In a place like Shelby, matter of fact, the whole state of Montana, for all practical purposes, there's less local government regulation on how you can heat your home, your sources of water, anything like that. Let me use as a barometer about three examples. I'll start with Viata Robinson, who occasionally pops here on It's My House. Viata Robinson, who some of you already know. Viata Robinson, who's originally from Chicago, grew up in Chicago, got married and lived in California, which I forgot what part of California. I don't know if it was part of Silicon Valley, but California in a standardized American house. Then the family moved to Orlando, where she lived in a nice-sized house with a swimming pool. And then she downsized, after her divorce, she downsized to a tiny house, 168 square feet. She lived in that for 5 years. Then she sold her first tiny house and saw a shed, and she converted the shed into her second tiny house, which is 320 square feet, all right? Black woman, black American woman. Now, and I'm using black women as a barometer of where the ball is going. Example number two, 2 months ago, almost 3 months ago, well, 3 months ago now, I interviewed here on It's My House, and we got it in the archives, three ladies from Metro Atlanta, okay? And they came to the conclusion, you know what? We're not going to solve Atlanta's problems. So they went out and they ran across a piece of land 2 hours away from Atlanta, and they put their heads together. Talk about cooperative economics. That's why I play the Claude Anderson piece every morning to start this show off. And the three of them got 19 families to pony up, and they bought 97 acres of land, and now they're up to at least the last time, well, 3 months ago, they might have more now, but 3 months ago, they were up to 502 acres. It's the Freedom Georgia Initiative. They have their own website. If you go to search in any search engine, Freedom Georgia Initiative, they have their own website. They have their own Freedom Georgia. That's their YouTube channel. Go look them up. See their progress. Once again, three black American women. Once again, I'm looking at them as a barometer of where the ball is going. All right. There's another woman that Viata interviewed. I think his name is Sika or Seka or something like that. Black woman originally from Baltimore, Maryland, and she bought 10 acres of land in Arizona. She might be up to 15 or 20 acres of land in Arizona. I'm going to see if we can get her on here. I've spoken to her twice offline, but we're going to try to get her on here. Third African-American woman, where the ball is going, and we're talking about they're setting themselves up in what I would call retail housing and in situations where they can actually legally practice energy independence, be free of municipal water, be free of municipal electricity, and or monopolize electricity and or natural gas. The next, so let's see, that's Viata, Seek in Arizona. You got three black women in Atlanta. Put, God knows, in the 19 families, they're beyond that now, they're all black. All barometers are where the ball is going. Now, the other, now, Viata just came back, and we'll see if I get on here this week. Viata just came back from Costa Rica. She was out there for a week. You have other black American females that are going to Mexico, Central America, South America, and other far-flung destinations. And one of the reasons why, I mean, you have, there are videos of YouTube, on YouTube where you have single black women, parents, single parents, but I'm talking about the black female ones, American, that they have moved to or have visited places like Colombia. Because what, once again, this is where the ball is going. I'm using them as a barometer. Because there are plenty of white couples that do this. There are plenty of single white women that do it. Plenty of single, couple white couples that do it. But when I see a black American woman do it, my antennas go way up. The ball is going that way. Now, there might not be a mass exodus of black folk or people in general, because, like I say, 86% of the American population are all crammed in only 3% of the available landmass. They're on the grid when it comes to municipal water and electricity and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, there were wake-up calls to the general mass population of Texas when they had the ice storm last year or the year before, within the last 2 years of the pandemic. There's another wake-up call that Mother Nature has given to people that are stuck out in parts of California right now that have snowed in. I saw one news story this morning, 12 feet of snow. You have some local governments that say, look, we can't help you. And you know what? The thing about government, no matter what a lot of politicians say, government cannot save everybody. On a local level, state level, or federal level, all combined, they can't save. What? Now, there are people out there, once again, out of the 141 million households in the United States, only 250,000 or so, give or take, are off the grid, meaning, so what is 12 feet of snow outside? I still got electricity. I still can watch my flat screen TV. I still can surf the internet all day and all night long. I can cook. My family hasn't and won't miss a meal because we're energy independent. What, Viata, the three black women that that founded the settlement of Freedom, Georgia, Seeker out of, and from Baltimore to Arizona with 15 to 20 acres of land, and the black American women that are in Central America, South America, and all over the globe now that have found energy independence, that's where the ball is going. No, a million people might not flow up. You know, 700,000 people have moved out of California within the last 2 years. That's across the board. The ball is going there. Now, the education part, let's go back to Montana. There are black folks moving to Montana. There's one black couple, they were in West Palm Beach, Florida. That's 3 hours away from me. And now they're on their own 40 acres in Montana. Energy independent. And typically, black Americans, at least the urban myth of it, we're typically last to get on board. Well, we're not last now. Well, not all of us, put it that way. So that's where the ball is going. Even professions, off-grid professions, they're STEM. But in addition to STEM, there's a bunch of professions that are out there that I would call emerging professions, like can you drill a well? Can you maintenance a well? I will look at those professions, you know, clearing land, anything that the Amish do, the Mennonites do, and the Hutterites do with those professions, jump into those professions. I'm looking at them on the same level as STEM. Same level. Because people are looking for a way, particularly we're in an age of inflation, maybe even hyperinflation globally. People are looking for a way to cut out the middleman. The middleman, in the context of this conversation, well, what I'm saying this morning, is how can I cut out the municipalities as much as possible? They got you by the balls to a certain degree if you own real estate, but people even have a way around that. All right, some people have a camping lifestyle. They'll live here for 6 weeks to 12 weeks, and then they rotate to another place. That's how some people roll with the seasons. I'm in Florida, and here in Florida, because it's March now, at the end of this month, snowbirds, they start going back north. By the end of April, they'll be out. They'll be back to Canada or whatever cold climate they came from. All right. Some people roll with the season, they got four places to live around the planet. But like I say, the black American woman, and I mean this in a positive light, you know, the majority of them, no, they're not off the grid. But once again, and I'm going to see if I can get a panel of them on here one day. Even, what's her name, Naima Latif in Chicago. She lives in a solar house trying to get that electric bill down, which I'm sure she's gotten it down because she's got a solar house. So that's where, in my opinion, the ball is going. More and more people, no matter what the regulators try to do, are going off the grid. So if you're looking for a career change, look for some industry, emerging industry, because, you know, you got people living in cars. You know, you can, you know, if you have the skill set on how to customize a car to take it from just not a car that you drive, that one that you can live in, or a van, or a scooter, like I say, YouTube is one of my favorite barometers, but within those videos, because, you know, you got black women who have taken, you know, horse trailers, you know, that they cart around, you know, horses in, you've got black women that, and I love the ingenuity of them, that they have converted those into tiny portable homes. And portable homes is another thing where that's where the ball is going. A lot people that are waking up, you know what, in my particular situation, not everybody's situation, but in their particular situation, they don't want to pay property taxes that go up every year. They don't want to, you know, take the chance of, you know what, this could end up on the tax blocks auction for sale. So you have them converting horse trailers into chic, not shabby, chic, mobile tiny homes. Like I said, Viata, in her latest place where she calls home, she took a shack and converted it into a tiny house. She's not the only one, but I'm just saying those are barometers that you can look at. And I'm looking at women, be it black, white, or you know whatever color or religion or race they might be. Women typically, because basically men with us, you know, women dictate where we're going to live, particularly if you're in a relationship. So if the wife is happy, everybody's happy. When mama's happy, everybody's happy. Okay, when mama's not happy, nobody's happy. So I'm just saying, keep your antennas up, and I'm looking at moving to Montana, Idaho, or any rural area, because you can be in North Carolina, South Carolina. People are waking up and saying, you know what? I can deal without the city. Now, some people might say, well, but the jobs in the cities, okay, well, let's look at that. Look up on YouTube or on Wikipedia, put in the words, or the terms, rather, super commuter or extreme commuter. And let's, matter of fact, let's look this up now before I go to the phone lines. Super commuter. All right, according to Wikipedia, a super commuter, and this is the age that we're living in right now in real time in 2023, a super commuter is a person who works in a central county or downtown core of a metropolitan area but resides outside the metropolitan area. In some metropolitan areas, the cost of living are inhibitive to the middle and lower income workers. As a result, some choose to live in a more affordable metropolitan area that are separate from the metropolitan area in which they work. Super commuters travel long distances either daily or once or twice a week between home to their workplace either by air, rail, bus, or sometimes also a car or a combination of modes. Often the super commuters spend most of the work week in a city of their office where the office is based, returning home on weekends. Super commuters are generally younger in age than the average worker and tend to be from a middle-class background. They're not the elite business travelers. They try to cut their costs by taking benefit of higher wages in one region and lower housing and transportation costs in a more affordable metropolitan area of where they reside. Now, that's the super commuter. All right. And a super commuter, that might be, you know, 90 minutes. You know, getting to work. Now, let's look up another term that's out here. Is extreme commuter. Now, that's what I am. I'm an extreme. I can do some things here where I'm at, but in other cases, I have to get out extreme commuters. Are the extreme commuters are defined as workers who travel 90 minutes or more to work one way. So if I go from here to D.C., the quickest way for me to do it is I got to get to Orlando and then catch a plane to D.C. And it's 2 hours. Then hop on the subway when I get to National, airport in D.C., and then take the train on into subway on into D.C. I had to do that when I was dealing. This is prior to It's My House. That's what. Twice a month, I was extreme commuting. Sometimes I catch a flight, go into town, go to whatever court hearing for 5 or 10 minutes, back to the train, the subway station, or trains. Sometimes I took a train, which is longer. But other times I took a plane. And I wasn't the only one doing that. I wasn't the only one sitting up in that Airbus. Or if I go from here to Taft, Oklahoma, okay, and that's something I can't pull off in a single day due to the fact of where Taft is. But I would have to fly either out of Orlando, Tampa, go to Tulsa, and Tulsa somebody picks me up in 45 minutes of Taft. That would be a week. I'd do a 7-day stay that way and then come back. But prior to It's My House, in some cases, like in one case, I had to go to New Orleans, catch a flight out of Tampa or Orlando, go to New Orleans, check on a couple of houses, and I might be at that house in only 2 hours. And then catch a flight back here the same day. But the thing is, I didn't have to do that every day. I didn't have to do it every month. I didn't have to do it every month. Sometimes I can get away without doing it for a few years. I haven't had to travel that way in the last 3 years. All right. So you have a lot of people that are either super commuters or extreme commuters. Some people, it might take them 2 to 3 hours to get to work one way. And they do their 8 hours, and then they got videos on this on YouTube. Now, with some jobs, you can telecommute. You can stay at home and work from home. So this is the age. I describe the age that we're living in now, 2023. This is an age of disruption. Through apps on your phone, you got Uber and Lyft. You really don't. I don't have a car. I don't need one. I either know people through social capital, or I got Uber on my. I prefer Lyft over Uber, but Uber app, Lyft app on my phone. If I can't reach out to my social capital, if they're not available, then I got two apps on the phone. Uber, those apps are they disrupted the taxi industry or the transportation industry. Airbnb disrupted the hospitality or accommodation industry, I think, in my opinion, in a positive light. People can work, can telecommute. That's what smartphones, the internet, desktops, laptops, and what do you call it, tablets, why pay for office rent when you can, all depends on the business now. Not every business is just set up the same. You're not going to telecommute and you got a job at Walmart. It just ain't happening unless you're in upper management. All right, you're not going to telecommute and work at McDonald's or the Dollar General store. That's not going to happen. All right, but there's several professions and jobs where you can telecommute. Teaching is the same way. You really don't. Depends on what you're teaching. Now, if you're teaching swimming, Okay, well, you need a brick-and-mortar pool that is easier to more properly. You're a crazy dog. You know, on how to teach that. However, if you're a music teacher, like piano or guitar or something like that, you know, you can teach a lot of that, or teaching a foreign language, you can telecommute that. You can do FaceTime in real time, you can teach that. All right. So it all depends on the particular profession. You know, not all professions you can telecommute or what have you. I met a couple in Pittsburgh. Their home is in Pittsburgh. And the wife, she's a housewife, she lives in Pittsburgh. But the husband, his 9-to-5 is in Boston. So he flies out to Boston, and then he flies home on the weekends. And there's a whole bunch of people that do that. Other people, they're on the ground. They might drive to work. They might drive 90 minutes to work one way. Some might watch one video on YouTube where the distance is 2 hours one way to work. They spend 6 hours a day commuting to work. I mean, to and fro work. So 3 hours to work, 8 hours at work, 3 hours back home. And they do it 5 days a week. Some people might have that same routine, but they might do the telecommuting, depending on the job. They might have to come into the office maybe once or twice a week. So we're living in an age of disruption. But like I say, included in that disruption, like I say, you're having more and more people that are becoming energy independent when it comes to their housing or what have you. Okay, anyway. So much for that. And I got a melagerie. You hear a dog in the background, that's Spaz. I got two dogs here and a pig. I'm babysitting, or pet sitting, as they call it. So, well, you know what? And it's lunchtime for Henry. Henry's the pig. So, okay, let me find my way back to the studio. And what I'm going to do before I go to the phone lines, because I was supposed to feed Henry the pig 3 minutes ago. So let me go take care of these. Wait a minute. All right, give me 3 minutes. Let me go feed Henry, check on Spaz, and come back.
You give me that funny feeling in my tummy.
Okay. Let's see. Henry is. I got it. Well, it's not a situation because I don't want folks to eat the pig food. So let. Oh man, where? All right. Anyway, we'll be back right after this.
Hi everyone, I am still at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous. We're going to shoot another video. We're going to meet Dee, who lives in her car, and we're going to find out how and why and just see what we can learn and share with others to help them in their journey into being a nomad and living their best possible life. So Dee, say hello.
Hello.
And why don't we just begin with the idea of how did you end up living in your car?
I was transient most of my childhood, and as an adult, I lived a civilized life and everything. In the last 4 years ago, I got a divorce, tried living on my own. It was very hard. It was almost impossible, and I finally got to the point where I couldn't pay the bills. I ended up going back to my ex-husband for 5 months, a very volatile situation. I can't continue living like that. So here I am. I've been watching Bob's videos on YouTube, and it made me think I could do it. And so on the first of this month, I took off. At first, I prepared my car. And I do have some income, not much.
Do you mind if I ask how much income you have?
I live on Social Security, a little over $800 a month.
Right.
And I have some bills, but not a lot. And
and that's nearly impossible to do in any traditional
mm-hmm.
home apartment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your whole apartment.
Well, I couldn't buy food.
Right.
I couldn't even buy food. I had to get free food. And it was hard. I couldn't pay. I couldn't buy anything. Nothing.
After
I couldn't go. Couldn't go with a friend for a $5 McDonald's. Nothing.
Right.
And I got tired of that, too.
It was not a good life.
No, it was not.
And because you have been a person who traveled and was transient, this appealed to you.
I always loved camping. Out of my five, there were five of us kids, but out of the five, I think I loved the camping. I did it when I was raising my kids. Took them camping all the time. I love camping. So the lifestyle is wonderful. I love it. I love the freedom. I love the fresh air. I love the camaraderie, I think you say it.
Right.
Meeting people. Finding other people that are just like me. You don't find that in the city.
No.
So.
Everyone's afraid of each other in the city.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so this was the car you had.
Right. It's a Pontiac, 2005 Pontiac Grand Am. It's a six-cylinder and four-door. And I really did have to do some changing to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And so far, so it's only been a month, about
right,
a month.
Right, about a month.
And you're a little too early to know, but so far, so good?
So far, so good. I'm determined I can do it for a few years in this. I'd like to upgrade to a van and become a van camper, but in the meantime, this is the way I have to live, and I'm not unhappy about it.
Good, because you're a nature girl camper anyway.
Right.
Okay, well, let's take, how do you, let this car go past, and then a couple questions that I know everyone's going to ask when you live in a car. You support yourself with a Social Security check?
Yeah.
And how do you go to the bathroom?
Well, it's hard in a car.
It's
so you have to really, you really have to work it out. I have two things. I have a pee bucket, basically, which I do not line. And I do have a lid for it, and I've actually kind of
so
covered it with a soft lining because women don't like to sit on these hard plastic things.
Right.
And then I funnel it into a one-gallon... Oops, sorry, Dolly. That's my dog, Dolly.
Okay.
I funnel it into a one-gallon water jug.
Mm-hmm.
And then I dump it where it needs to be dumped. For the other job, number two, basically poop.
We all do it.
I have another bucket that is the same size that I fit into that bucket, and I line it with a good plastic bag, and I do my business, and then I take the business and I twist it, and I fold it over again, and I twist it again, and I fold it over again. I do about four times, and then I put it into a Ziploc bag. So there's no smell.
Right.
And I don't have to think about it after that. I'm
right.
done.
Right.
And
that's exactly what I do.
It's quick and it's convenient, and then I dump it when I get to somewhere where I can. If it gets uncomfortably, like, too much, then I'll go ahead and find a place to take it.
Right.
But it really hasn't been a problem at all. And the other thing I did when I set up my car for this is I made sure that I had a bench. A lot of your vans can use 5-gallon buckets. If I use a 5-gallon bucket, you're going to see my rear end in the window.
Right.
I have a 2-gallon bucket.
Right.
Which is perfect, and I put a board. I don't know if you want me to describe how I set this up. But,
Looks like you took out your back seat.
I took out the passenger seat and the back seat. And I built the wooden frame, and I put a 5-inch memory foam mattress on there. I cut it down. I bought a twin size and had to cut it all down. But it fits really nice, and it's the full length, and it only goes to the trunk. So I still have my whole trunk available. And then I built a wooden seat here. And I have a pillow up there that actually sits on this as a cushion.
So this is, so you lounge right here.
I can lounge there. I can sit my bucket on there. I can bathe. If I have to be in my car, I have a one burner butane stove that I can sit because that bench is very stable. I can sit this stove on there and I don't have a problem with the wind and I can cook. And I don't know if you got the propane heater there.
I see you have a Mr. Buddy.
Yeah, and the only thing you have to do when you have a Mr. Buddy in a car is you have to make sure that you have about 3 inches of air ventilation. Now, that Mr. Buddy will burn me out.
Right.
5 minutes is all it takes to heat up my car. And I use Reflectix on my windows. I didn't really need the Velcro, but I'm using it. But if you're going to use Velcro, you need a stronger glue because the glue on the back of Velcro is terrible.
Right.
So I just cut them to shape. One of the things that I did with my car, because it's going to be my living home, is that when I took my seats out, I took up the carpet and put Reflectix under the carpet so that the floor is not pulling up a lot of cold.
Right. You have Reflectix under.
Right. Underneath the rug.
Right.
And then one of the other things that I need to do, and I didn't do it, but I just put plastic between the bed and what have you in the trunk
mm-hmm.
to keep out some of the cold from the trunk. I will eventually put a board there that can also convert into a table because I will make screw-on legs. The little basket over there in the corner, one of the hardest things to do is when you're going to the bathroom is to find the toilet paper in a car.
Oh, yeah.
So that's where I keep my wipes and my toilet paper hooked in a basket and bungeed to one of the little hooks up there.
And what's the tarp for?
And the tarp is just between the seat and the trunk. It should be a board, but right now it's a tarp.
Right. So kind of insulation?
Yeah, to keep some of the cold from the trunk from coming into the car.
And you just built, made blocks.
It's I showed you from the other side.
Yeah, we see it from the other side. Okay.
Well,
taking out the passenger seat and the back seat really opened it up.
It made so much room in here. I mean, that is almost 24 inches wide. So 2 feet. In the house that I was in, I had a 24-inch wide bed, believe it or not.
That is pretty small.
So, yeah. But what I have here is a memory foam mattress that I covered with a wool. I made this myself. I just took a wool blanket and sewed it over it. So nothing really sticks or, you know, sometimes the foam, you know, it kind of causes everything to not move.
Right.
So this moves, and I just put a regular sheet on it and tuck it under. And then here's the board. I used 2x2s and 1/2-inch plywood. And I'm not sure if I can do this, Bob, but this is interesting. I don't do this often, but, oh, incidentally, you can use this for storage also, I mean, for putting things under the mattress. So I have lots of things under here. I have a flip-up, I have it actually hinged or coming up this way.
Right.
so that I can get in.
So direct access.
So under there is my clothes. This is my dirty clothes and my medications, because I take a few. There's a lot of cubbies you can stuff things
right,
in.
Right, right.
And in the front, you can see, under here I have a ton of stuff. I crochet. I have a toolbox up there on the front. I have a bag with crochet, yarn, needles and stuff. I have a sewing box here. I have all my propane bottles under there and a little bag with my dog's toys and jackets and what have you. And then on this part, actually, that screen tent over there fits in there, and my lantern with the case also fits in there.
Wow.
So it's just a ton of room under there to put things. I don't have a bunch of electricity or electrical products. So I found a 5-watt solar kit. Doesn't have the battery pack or anything. So I just plug directly into it and charge my iPad and my cell phone.
Right.
Has both a lighter plug and a USB.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 150-watt power inverter that I plug into my cigarette lighter or this, and I have electrical plug on that with a USB that I can use. I have two solar lights. One is the, what's it called? The
Lucy?
The Lucy light, which was $15 at Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes the inside of that car so bright, I couldn't believe it. I just got it yesterday. I have another light that I bought on Amazon for $10. It's a three-way light. You can operate it strictly on solar, just charge it up every day in the sun, and you've got light for 8 hours. Or I can plug it into USB to charge it. Or I can put batteries in it. So it's wonderful because it serves me no matter where I'm at, no matter what the weather conditions are.
It's rainy, you can put in batteries.
Exactly. I have, because of the way I designed the inside of the car, I have tons of room.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
In
huge,
my trunk. The one thing that takes up a lot of space that I do have is my camping kitchen, but it does fold up to the size of this rectangle and about 5 inches deep. And because of my handicaps, I can't do a lot of squatting and bending.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm able to stand there and cook. So my screen tent was about $40. I think I bought it about 12 years ago.
And this, what year is your Pontiac Grand Am?
It's a 2005.
2005.
Yeah. It's
what you have.
Yeah, it's what I had.
And you probably get pretty good gas mileage out of it?
I get between 25 and 28 miles to the gallon.
That's, which is good.
Which I'm not going to get that in any other vehicle.
No.
So if I have to move around a little bit, it's not costing me a fortune.
Right.
I spend no more gas traveling than I would in town going to the store every day and doing stuff like that. So it's really good. Maintenance is a lot cheaper on a car than it is on a larger vehicle.
Very much.
And I just recently, last year, spent a little money putting on new wheels and rims.
Mm-hmm.
And did a lot of work by myself, believe it or not. I'm 64 years old, but I've been disabled for the last 4 years. I worked for 8 years, and I was disabled 5 years before that in a wheelchair. So I worked my way out of all of that just by hard work and determination. So
a lot of what you want to do is, because the car is tiny, but you're on public land for the most part.
Right.
You're going to get outside and live outside.
Right. And that's where the screen tent comes in. I'm thinking of getting a dome tent with a screen tent on it. But this is going to do for a while. And what I've done is set up the screen tent right next to my car. And then in here, I purchased this camp kitchen on Amazon for about $110, I think. Maybe not even that much. And it's great because it has your top for your stove. It does come with a windscreen, but it's short, so I add reflectors to make it a little higher. It has a great little cloth cupboard with a hard tray in the bottom so that it doesn't dip.
Mm-hmm.
This here is a fold-out, and it has a sink, and it has a dish rack.
My kids can
cooler.
Uh-huh. And I have a
water jug.
A medium-sized cooler. It's a three-day cooler, which is wonderful because with block ice, it will actually last 4 or 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is a collapsible water jug,
mm-hmm,
which is great. I bought this with the sunshade. I don't really need the sunshade. I wish I hadn't bought the sunshade one.
Right.
But because it takes up a little more room. But everything is compact. My little table I've had for about 30 years.
Uh-huh.
And it's a little folding table. It just collapses like these chairs do. And my little tripod. Now for storage. For one thing, I keep a gallon water jug. And I keep it for grease. Or little bits of gray water that have a lot of food or something in it. You can strain gray water, get the food out of it, and then you don't feel so bad about when you have to dump water.
Mm-hmm.
I keep a thing here with 3 different sizes of Ziploc bags because they're good for everything.
Mm-hmm.
I save all my grocery bags. I use those for trash or for whatever, and when I run out, I still have other bags. I have 3 pots. That's all I carry. I have a little skillet with a folding handle. I have a small pot and a medium pot. This is not a huge pot. These are stainless steel, so they don't burn, they don't stick, and they're wonderful. They're wonderful. I do everything in them. That's my pots and pans. All my dishes are in this bag. I get collapsible things as much as possible. That's a collapsible bowl. And then the silicone, you saw that yesterday, the silicone strainer. I had another one, too, which is a collapsible strainer. That's more of a steamer. And I don't have all collapsible yet. I made some things. I don't know if you saw the bag on the back of my seat, on the driver's seat.
I did.
Yeah, okay. So that's got all those goodies. I'm a crafty person sometimes. And I made these bags out of towels that have slots. And I still have to put the straps on them so that I can hang them. And then I have easy access to all of my utensils. I have one for cooking utensils and one for my silverware. And I made those, just sewed some seams down them. And I do keep a cutting board because I don't want to cut on this.
So by cooking out, you save a substantial amount of money and eat a little healthier.
Right. And the windscreen keeps me from using quite as much fuel.
Right.
All my food is stored in these bags. I got these at the dollar store or something, Dollar General, for $1.99 a piece. They're vinyl, and they're zippered bags.
Yeah.
And so if they're empty, like plastic, I started out with nothing but plastic containers.
Mm-hmm.
They took up so much space. And so I said, I got to do something because I'm just too cramped. I bought these, and they're collapsible, so you can stick them in nooks and crannies if there's hardly anything in them.
Right.
And I separate my dry goods from my canned goods, and then the other one is for, like, taller bottles and things.
Mm-hmm.
And I have another one that I just have been putting water in, but, I mean, I could put other things in it. I think these would be great for clothing bags, too, because they're covered. And that's pretty much it. I do have a thermos because I don't want to have to keep reheating water.
Right.
And
well, your experience as a camper has just really paid off for you.
Yeah, it's helped me a lot because I'm not afraid of camping. And coming to your seminar has helped me not to be afraid of predators.
Right.
Okay, so this seminar that the RTR that you give every year has an abundance of information for anybody who's trying to survive.
Why don't you come on out in the sun?
I'm sure
anyone can see you.
Okay. But I'm learning a lot of survival skills here. It's a great place to make connections with people. I've met some really nice people that we're going to connect throughout the year, you know, and maybe meet up in different places. And so I'm just really happy to be here, and that's about it, Bob.
Indeed, you just, it's amazing.
I do want to introduce my little dog. This is Dolly.
Dolly's in the shade. And
she is my best friend and companion, and she loves camping.
She's keeping her eye on that camera.
Yes, she is.
Well, Dee, I think you've given a lot of hope to a lot of people who are a lot of women, and men, too, are in your situation. And the fact that you took your seats out is amazing because it's a huge amount of room in there.
We have YouTube videos that tell you exactly how to do it on almost any car.
Right.
And there's YouTube videos on how to make your bed, too. So a little creativeness and a little, you know, take a little bit from what they give you and modify it to fit yourself.
Right.
I couldn't sleep on just an air mattress or those one-inch foam because of my health, because I have some really bad back and neck problems and fibromyalgia and a bunch of other things. But with that memory foam mattress, I sleep like a baby. And I don't even use a sleeping bag. I'm using a down comforter folded in half. And it's so warm, I never get cold in bed.
Wow, that's
never.
Great. We've had some cool nights, too.
So, yes, we have. It gets cool in the car, right, but it doesn't get cool in my bed.
Right.
So.
Well, I think you've given a lot of hope to a lot of people that this is a good life and they can do it.
Yes, anybody can do it if you want to or if you have to.
You're at a head start because you're a camp. You like camping anyway,
mm-hmm.
but anyone can figure it out.
Right.
Well, Dee, thank you so much for your sharing your experience with us and your hope, and I'm really glad that we can share this with so many other people.
Thank you.
And everyone, thanks for watching this video, and I hope you liked it and learned something, and like us on YouTube and subscribe to the channel, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, now in that audio, and this deals with our topic, I'm trying to tie it in, energy independence, retail, solar, and retail housing. There, in that audio, and we'll follow up on this tomorrow, think of STEM, okay? Now, in addition to the STEM professions, which you're going to have to go to college for that, and maybe graduate school in some cases, there are two other, what I deem, industries, emerging industries, that can bring you, in my opinion, just as much money or maybe more money than STEM. And I'm breaking it down into what I call the lifestyle professions and the off-the-grid professions. For instance, auto to house conversions. That's an emerging industry where people, you just heard this lady's 64 years old. Okay, when they did that audio or video that you just heard. So you have people out there taking seminars or workshops or retreats on how to take their car and convert it into a home. That's an emerging industry. You might not think it is, but there's a bunch of videos on YouTube, not one, two, or three, but hundreds, if not thousands by now. Another one would be healthcare, off-grid healthcare. Somebody who has been trained as a nurse or some other type of, maybe a doctor or a medical professional, but the market of their clientele live. They don't live in the city. Matter of fact, or a densely populated area. There was a video that I watched last night talking about housing. In order to afford housing in the future, you're going to have to be rich. I didn't put that title on it. They did. And I'm going to see if I can get that audio on here tomorrow. So as more and more people opt to leave some of your larger metro areas where you have, like, unsustainable housing prices, you know, because in some cases you've got to come in with $300,000-$500,000 liquid to get into a place. So healthcare professionals, off-grid healthcare professionals, that I'm including that in the off-grid professionals as well as lifestyle professionals. Those are two separate categories. I coined both of those terms. All right. Safe parking accommodations. UCLA. All right, they're down to big on. UCLA, they have a Facebook page, but they have a safe parking accommodation. I've mentioned this before. UCLA has quite a critical mass of students that cannot afford to rent a house or even rent a room or share a room in a house, but they have a car and they can afford the tuition. So UCLA has dedicated a parking lot called, it's a safe parking space. They're not the only ones that do it. You have some cities that are adopting this. This is new. This is an emerging industry where the students can take their car, van, or whatever. They can park there overnight. Nobody's going to bother them. No law enforcement, no campus police, no LAPD, none of that business. And they've got a safe place to park. It's their home. And there's showers there. There are clean bathrooms there. You can even buy food to eat. Safe parking comes under that. There might be even a Wikipedia page on it now. You're going to have some cities that are going to adopt that as a zone too. Some have already done it, and I think that's going to catch on. Apps, look what it did for Airbnb and accommodations industry, Uber, Lyft, transportation, and there'll be professions that will emerge out of those two, believe me. Glamping, you know, some people just like any old thing will do to camp, but glamping is luxurious or glamorous camping. That's an emerging industry. Just, look, there are people out here that are making $50,000 or more a month glamping. And house sitting. House sitting, and that's how the origins of It's My House. I had a house sitter that tried to take my house. But you know what? I love the internet so much. As a barometer, if you go online and type in house sitting or how to make money house sitting is a profession now if you know how to do it. It's a profession. And there's somebody online that teaches this too. So those are just six what I call within the I'm putting it on the same level as STEM. Now, STEM's more difficult, but I'm talking about emerging professions or where you can earn a sustainable living to support a family. I got it in two general categories, the lifestyle professions and the off-the-grid professions. That last, and all of them have to deal with energy independence. The 64-year-old lady that we listen to, yeah, she's got to put gas in the tank and all that, but she's not receiving an electric bill. She's not receiving a gas bill, you know, that's one, two. She's not receiving any of that, although she's got to put gas in the tank, I'm just saying. All right, let me take one call, then I'm out. Let's see, 314, your mic is open.
Hell, you having a whole full 1 hour, man. Did you get my email?
I got on.
Did you get my email? I asked you, did you want to come on a show and explain your expertise?
What show was that? Oh, you know what? I haven't even checked my email.
If not, somebody else going to take your place.
I'm looking at my email right now. I don't see.
It's either email or a text message.
Oh, let me check my. Oh, let me check
the 17th or the 31st of this month. It can't be no longer than 15 minutes.
All right, I
so you
I
got to arrange your presentation in that length of time and be open for questions.
Hey, well, I got you on the phone now. All right. Email from you.
Huh?
Hey. I don't see an email or a text from you. I'm in my text right now. I don't see a text, and I don't see nothing in the email. Okay, well
look,
break it down for me. What is it? Or you said you
I ain't gonna tell you online. You're gonna have to address the question. email. Let me see if I can find here.
Let me put it in this way. Let me put your name in. Okay.
Yeah, it is right there. It was 10:40 a.m. I sent it to you. March the 4th.
And you texted it to me or you sent it by email?
I'm reading it right now.
Because I'm looking at... Okay. All right.
Text.
Okay, I'm waiting. All right, it hasn't reached me yet.
Today is the 6th, ain't it? Today is March the 6th. I said you March the 4th.
Okay, hold it. You sent it March the 4th. And you sent it by text? All right, hold it. Wait a minute.
Yeah, L.A. Davis.
All right,
10:34 a.m.
Okay, wait a minute. And you said March. Oh, this is. All right. This thing won't. I'm looking like Pianchi.
I asked you the question, what is black culture? And you said, good question. Monday's topic. Thanks.
Oh, man, you're right. Doggone it. Hold it. I'm trying
then
to.
Then I went on and asked you about coming on the being on the show.
Okay, I got it. I'm looking at it now.
All right, well, I'll talk to you later. Let me know.
All right, I'll get back to you today. All right, thanks. All right, people, we're going to wrap it up. Find my way back to the studio here. Okay, Blog Talk. Okay. All right. I don't want to give it an absolutely old outro, but. Okay, we're still here. I'm waiting for my phone to load up, people. And I don't want to refresh. Okay, here we go. Now. All right. Let's see. Let me find something. All right, now I want to do my regular way. Okay, well, you got tomorrow's topic already, so. Okay, here we go. Have a great day.